If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
You know, my first encounter with LRT systems was in the mid-80s. I lived in Calgary from 86 to 89, including there for the Winter Olympics. It was incredible. And I remember being mesmerized at this city that, you know, was in the middle of nowhere and just right into the middle of the Rockies or just at the foot of the Rockies there. And, you know, a completely self-contained, self-sufficient city. And then they got this LRT system, which in the 80s, not many had it. And I remember specifically being on it and riding to a hockey game, an Olympic hockey game, with my girlfriend at the time, and saying we were the only ones on the train that were speaking English because there were so many international tourists. It was, it is and was a great success. They've added to it since I've been there. On the other hand, you look to places like Ottawa and you go, what a shite show. You know, mind you, we certainly know the history of Ottawa and what has happened, you know, over the course of the last little while with their past mayor and such. But, you know, it seems that in the 80s we could pull it off, yet in this era we can't. What's the difference? How does Hamilton make sure we don't make the same mistakes? And we all know in this area this has been a very, very, very long journey. Let's bring in Sean Sagan, creator and editor of Rail Fans Canada, a platform dedicated to the exploration and discovery of all of rail public transit across Canada, and is here now. Shane, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Shane, this is one, you know, at least analogy I can identify with, because I've lived in Calgary way back when, and they were pulling it off back in the 80s. And then what we've seen and just the screw-ups in Ottawa, just from an over perspective, can you give us an idea? Why is one working? Why did one have so much problem?
Well, it's really a complicated situation. I mean, you know, I live in Ottawa and I'm a big supporter of the O train and I want to see the system succeed and be well perceived by the public. But it's been a very difficult journey ever since it opened in September 2019. You know, we've had, you know, unfortunately, two derailments. Nobody was hurt, thankfully. And, you know, other issues, wheel bearings failing. You know, power issues, doors. Most of these issues have been fixed since the opening. It's taken a long time to get to that point. But the main issue that we currently have right now, and that led to a nearly 1 month shutdown just weeks ago, is due to the wheel bearings and the axles on the trains not being able to handle the profile of the track. So lots of sharp turns and things like that. And you know, it's disappointing to see this, because this was everybody's expectation was this was going to be very transformative for the city. And I think in a sense it has been, because you see a lot of transit-oriented development popping up around the stations and different connections being made. It definitely looks nicer than seeing buses lined up end-to-end from one end of downtown to another.
Shane, Shane, I don't want to have the debate whether LRT is good or bad, because I'm for it. I think it's a great idea. But let's be honest, this has been a royal screw-up and does nothing to help cities like Hamilton who are trying to get in it and fighting the same sort of battle. So What can we learn from this? Was it a bad plan? Was it a bad execution? And again, I mean, there's been issues within Ottawa City Council that have been, you know, shoddy to say the least over the past couple of years. I mean, the wheels are falling off the place. So with that, I mean, what can we learn from this so Hamilton doesn't make the same mistakes that Ottawa has?
Well, you know, the issue in Ottawa really is that, there's multiple issues. Okay, so for example, the trains are low floor. That was a decision that they made because at one point in the past, very, very early on, it was supposed to run on the streets like a streetcar. Downtown or in the outskirts of the city. That quickly got changed to being completely separated, but yet the requirement for a low floor train remained. And the requirements in Ottawa were high speed, high capacity, and unfortunately very sharp turns. These trains can't handle it. And they're very, you know, they're Alstom Citadis trains. That is a model of train that's used all around the world, but this is a customized new version that they made specifically for America. For North America. So Ottawa's the first one to use it. Toronto on the Finch West is going to be using the same train model. And apparently, it was announced that Quebec City is going to be getting the same thing yet again. Like the problem really is why didn't they just say, you know what, we're not going to be on the street? Why didn't they use high floor trains? You know, something more proven. That would probably have solved a lot of issues. I mean, these trains just are having so much trouble because low floor means the bogies, the wheels, the motors are crammed into such a small space that,
It
you know,
sounds to me, it
certain
sounds to me,
issues had to be,
Shane.
resolved by miniaturizing everything, and it just can't handle it.
It sounds to me, Shane, it's not the equipment. It's not the right for the job. And these are people that are making decisions. Who is driving the bus or train in this case? Because it seems like, you know, there's a lot of bad decisions being made, and you're realizing that afterwards.
Well, see, in Ottawa, it was a P3, so a public-private partnership. And when you look at how those are supposed to work, you would think that the city would have brought on experts to advise them on what they should do, right? But it seems like, you know, we had a public inquiry and a lot of details came to light. And some of those details were we wanted a hollow axle instead of a solid axle, and we wanted the train to be like this, and we wanted it to do like that. And then in the testimonies, Alstom was even saying, you know, no train existed to meet these requirements. Like, we have to design something from scratch and very customized to be able to meet these very specific requirements that you're putting on us. So I think, you know, where does some of the issues come from? I think there's a lot of, you know, blame and pointing at people all around the table, but maybe the city had their hand in the cookie jar a little too much, saying, you know, we want it like this and we want it like that. And I'm not talking about colors or seat color here, like very specific technical specifications of the mechanics.
I wrote down as you were talking, too many cooks in the kitchen, which is basically what you just said. You know, it's sad, Shane, because it seems this is less about LRT and more about dysfunctional leadership.
It seems like that. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody meant wrong with all this, but the end result with, you
Absolutely,
know, so many things, this is where we're at right now. I mean, right now we're looking at potentially 2 to 3 years for them to redesign, because that's what they're saying. If we redesign and install new wheel assemblies, you know, the axle bearings and all, and the wheels and all that, this will effectively solve the root problem. Everything will be fine after that, but that's still 2 to 3 years. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, public perception is destroyed even further. But by that point, it's going to be 6, 7 years since the thing launched. So it's pretty rough for the people in the city, and the public transit reputation has been pretty destroyed.
Shane
You know, you have a lot of
Sagamore's
people that
creator.
bought cars, and that's pretty much how they're going right now. So clearly, that's the wrong direction you want people taking.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
unfortunately,
Well, hopefully
that's
you'll
where
get it.
people are left to.
Hopefully you'll get it sorted out. Shane Sagan with his creator, editor of Rail Fans Canada, a platform dedicated to the exploration and discovery of rail public transit across Canada. Here's hoping Hamilton can learn something from all of this experience. Shane, thank you for the time. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know me, I'm a bit of a space nut, and whenever things get a little too wacky down here, gets a little too intense, a little too frustrating, it's cool to look up into the stars and see what's going on up there. And many have said we are in a space race right now, and it has already begun. What will it look like in the future? Today, India became the first country to land a spacecraft near the moon's south pole after their probe made a historic voyage to uncharted territory that scientists believe could hold vital reserves of various things. And we'll find out more about all of that from Ram Jakhu, professor researching in international space law, McGill University, and with us now. Ram, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Thank you very much for asking. I'm doing very well.
So, Ram, what is your first impression now, India into this game?
Oh, I'm very much excited as a person interested in space, and as an ordinary person. I think this is a very historic moment for humanity, I will say, and especially for India.
The more the merrier here, the more hands on deck, the better, the more we learn.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I believe nobody has a monopoly on good ideas. Good ideas can come, good developments can come from anywhere. So when the future of humanity is involved, is at stake, I think we should be encouraging all countries, people, to do something good for the humanity. So I think India has started or has been doing, and as it's making good progress for the betterment of the humanity.
Where does this leave other countries who are also in the space race? The space race makes it sound like a competition, and as you made reference to, it would be nice if it was more a cooperation. But what does this say to other countries, whether it's United States, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, who all have programs of their own?
Well, I think it all depends on the individuals involved, the leaders and the scientists. What is their perception? Some may see is as in inspiration. For example, some countries may aspire to achieve what India has done, particularly countries from global south and other countries like Canada or some of the European countries. The others may perceive as a challenge. So it remains to be seen. To me, and I hope really it should lead to cooperation for two reasons. First thing is stakes are very high. If we have conflicts in space, I can tell you that nobody is going to be winner. The conflict in space will not be confined to space, but on Earth. And cooperation is necessary to ensure the future of humanity, particularly with respect to resources, which are depleting very fast on planet Earth. So I think it should be seen or perceived and considered to be an occasion to reflect and determine the future of humanity, looking for resources more in a cooperative manner.
India, the first country to land a spacecraft near the moon's south pole. What's the significance of the south pole? Why is this important, the location where they are?
I must say I'm not a scientist, but whatever I heard, it is important because there is a strong possibility there is a fairly large reserves of ice. That means water. Water is a source for people to sustain life, for it's important for a human to live. And more importantly, it can provide hydrogen and oxygen for missions on the moon and beyond the moon. So that is why this area is considered to be very important.
So it is an area that could be perhaps inhabited, not by us here, not by any extraterrestrial or anything. But it's does this help when we talk about landing on the moon on the way to Mars, space stations, this sort of thing?
Yeah, there's a strong possibility, but it all will depend what kind of ice is there, where it is available, how it can be extracted, how it can be used, but. Person like me believe there's a strong possibility for humans to go and settle in that part of the moon.
Is this about harvesting the moon in the future? There's things up there that are valuable to people back here on Earth.
I think that is a strong incentive for different countries and companies to go there. The race in the 70s, for example, was mainly more in the terms of prestige. Geopolitics was the major factor at that time. Geopolitics, by the way, it is still prevalent nowadays, but currently it's more with respect to the exploitation of natural resources on the moon, which are known, it's known that they are plentiful for resources which will be of indispensable value for humanity on Earth.
What about laying claim to certain parts of the moon? Many say this is like the exploration of North America centuries ago and capturing it for various entities and such. Is it similar in that way?
It should not be. It could be similar. The reason I believe is that humans will be doing the same thing which they have done on Earth. That's a sad thing. But I think people should be, not only the government alone, I think the people like you and me and people who your listeners should be concerned about the consequences of conflict in space. So I think the rules and regulations and policies should be set in place before exploitation begins. So it's important that all the efforts are more or less on are made on the basis of cooperation than conflict. And that is a possible. Efforts have been made. We have the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, and we had a 1979 Moon Agreement. Those treaties are in place. So I think countries should and companies should comply with those international agreements.
So is it easier for us to get along in space? It's a clean slate, sort of. I mean, many are asking if we can't get along on Earth, how do we get along in space? But the International Space Station is certainly proof of that.
Yeah, that's right. But I think there's no difference between cooperation in space and cooperation on Earth, or conflict in space and conflict on Earth. They are tied to. If there's a cooperation or not, there will be cooperation in space. Largely, of course, there will be some areas which there is no cooperation. But I think if there's a conflict in Earth, there will be conflict in space, or vice versa. So I don't really see difference that you can cooperate in space but not on Earth, or the other way around.
What about from a military aspect? We were talking about harvesting the moon before. Are people looking at it from a military point of view?
Well, there's an international treaty I mentioned to you earlier, 1967 treaty, mm-hmm. to which 120 countries are party to, including United States, Canada, and Russia and China. That prohibits the exploitation of resources in a number of ways under certain conditions, but more importantly, to directly answer your question, that prohibits all military activities on the moon.
So Ram Chakoo with us.
Says that, military presence can be there.
Ram Chakoo with us, professor, research in international space law. India has just landed a spacecraft near the moon's south pole. More getting involved. And Ram talking about us all getting along. McGill University is where he's from. Ram, thank you so much for the time and insight. Fascinating issue. Be well.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you on your show. You're doing a very good job.
Ryan Amato, Chief of Staff for the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing, has resigned after being in the spotlight as part of the investigation into the provincial government's Greenbelt land swap controversy. We know what this is all about. Developers given the cue, given the nod that Greenbelt lands were going to be opened up, and it looks like somebody had their hand in the cookie jar. How far up does this go? Chief of staff first to resign, and now we're hearing today that the RCMP is looking into whether an investigation is warranted here. Let's bring in Alan Hale, Ontario legislative reporter, Queen's Park Today and Here Now. Alan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Seems to be a bit of a building story, Alan.
Well, it's been a bit of a building story for months and months and months, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But I think today was definitely a significant milestone.
So how can a chief of staff or a minister step down or resign or take the heat, fall on the sword, whatever you want to use for an analogy, and not the actual minister himself? Why has he not stepped down? What are you hearing?
Well, I think what it really comes down to here is that the government does not really think that what has happened with the Greenbelt is all that bad. Really, only after the Auditor General's report came out, and we heard about how Mr. Amato, who you referenced, had been given envelopes at a building industry party, and how he had taken the requests inside them for removing property from being from environmental protection in the Greenbelt, and he bent over backwards to make that happen. Basically, the government has just said, oh, that was just a rushed process. It could have been done better, but really, it's the actual decision wasn't bad, and we're going to stick by it, and we're going to push ahead with building housing on that land because Ontario really needs housing. So to have Clark step down, as people have been demanding, including at the Association of Municipalities conference, which was this week, which I thought was quite something. Like, to have him step down would be to admit that something untoward has happened here, and that is not something right. the government has actually admitted to. The only thing they've right. admitted to so far is that this was a rushed and flawed process that could have been done better, but otherwise, nothing seriously bad happened here.
So, is there a relationship between the old Pickering Airport lands that have been on hold for 100 years and the Greenbelt? Do these two intersect in any way?
I am not sure, unfortunately. What I've heard is the Pickering lands is mostly agricultural, with developed land around the sides of it, which is a point that the premier has made a few times. Most of the criticism about the Pickering lands is about the fact that it is agricultural. Right. We heard a bit about that at the conference I was talking about. We know the Pickering Council is not in favor of this, but the government has pointed out that the Pickering mayor is in favor of building on the Greenbelt. So it's sort of, you have a little bit of a divide between some pro-development mayors and some, I don't want to call them anti-development councils, but some more skeptical councils.
Yeah,
and
it's, you know, there you go.
You can see that with the announcement this week about giving more mayors strong mayor powers without the need of the support of their councils, which is something Ford announced like 2 days ago.
So what is happening now? We understand that RCMP is going to look into this. OPP have moved it over to them to avoid any sort of perception of conflict of interest. So now they are examining to see whether an investigation is needed. What's happening here?
Okay, so it's a bit of an interesting time we've been having this morning. We got a confirmation we got a confirmation from the RCMP that a investigation is in its infancy, but they sort of backtracked that really quickly and said, we're just doing an assessment, and that they're going to look at the evidence, and they're going to determine right. whether a actual investigation is warranted. And that's pretty standard for police mm-hmm. investigations. They usually do take a look and see if there is anything, if there's any fire to the smoke. And, you know, if they find anything, then you can sort of build on that and get a criminal investigation going. And whether that goes anywhere or not depends entirely on the evidence. But the fact that what I find really interesting is that the OPP decided that it was not in a position to do this investigation because they were worried about a perceived conflict of interest. And which they haven't explained what that possible conflict of interest is. So they've handed it over to the RCMP to sort of, you know, keep this at arm's length. So I think that is quite interesting, but it's bad to have the like public confirmation that there's been an investigation and the AOPP apparently thought something had happened seriously enough that they didn't want to have to be the ones to investigate it. That's never good news for the government.
Isn't it good news, though, if there is the chance of a perception of bias that you put it on to somebody else? You know, it's interesting when the OPP, if the OPP was to do it, people would say, well, there might be a conflict of interest there. And now when the RCMP are doing it, well, they're hiding something. And like, so like, I don't know. I just think putting it to a neutral police service doesn't admit guilt, does it? It's just, isn't it a perception of bias? No. Are you more skeptical than that?
I think you're right. I mean, the there's really nothing to say that, like, in any of this that they have found something. There's, like, we can't really draw that conclusion. You know, it's all speculation at this point.
All right, but Alan Hill with his... Sorry, yeah. Go ahead. Finish up. Go ahead. Finish up.
Oh, I'm sorry. But, yes. But it is a... It is interesting that, the OPP didn't think they could have this because we know Doug Ford is so pro-police and he has, like, sons-in-laws who are police officers.
I think there's your answer right there, Alan. Alan Hill with his Ontario legislative reporter for Queen's Park Today in the great Greenbelt debate.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
You might remember a few weeks ago, we were talking about the situation in Russia and the Wagner Group, which a group of mercenaries who were helping out the Russian military and such. And then there was conflict between the two of some sort. And at one point, they were marching towards Moscow. It looked like there was some sort of coup about to happen. And then in the middle of the weekend, that kind of stopped, and they turned around and went in the other direction. And I believe the chief flew to Belarus. I may be wrong there. And now we're hearing has died in a plane crash. To talk more about all of this, Dr. Jack Cunningham, PhD program coordinator at the Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History, Trinity College, Monk School, University of Toronto, and with us now. Jack, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Hope you are, too.
So, Jack, many people I talked to, and maybe you were included in this group, said that he may disappear. Does any of this surprise you? What are your thoughts on what has transpired here?
The only thing that surprises me is how long it took. I don't think we should shed any tears over Mr. Prigozhin. He was a thoroughly nasty character. But I've expected for some time that Mr. Putin would find some way to get rid of him. I mean, as long as he was alive, he was a thorn in Putin's side and a potential rallying point for the disaffected, even in quasi-exile in Belarus.
So what do we know about this crash? What happened? Who else was on the plane?
We don't know much about it at all. But we know that there were seven passengers and three crew. It was a small plane, a private plane, one of two Wagner Group planes that were flying out of the main airport in Moscow. The Russian state media have released a video that purports to show the plane crashing. Its authenticity has, I suppose, yet to be determined. But that's about all we know. And the Russian authorities have promised an investigation. But I don't think we can take that at face value.
Is there any evidence at this point of sabotage or anything leading to why the plane actually went down?
We just don't know. We don't know exactly what happened. Although I think just in terms of the balance of probabilities, the likeliest thing is that it was sabotage. Mr. Putin had a very strong motive to get rid of Mr. Prigozhin, and he certainly has his tentacles spread out in such a way that it would be possible for him to do so.
Private plane, so assuming these were all friends or at least acquaintances in some way, business associates, what have you?
Yes.
So I guess no love lost for the others on board either then.
No. I mean, the Wagner Group is basically a group of thugs. There's no two ways about it. I think what will be interesting will be how Putin tries to allocate blame. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he tried to blame this on Ukraine, although in fact Prigozhin would have been much more used to the Ukrainians alive than dead, as an irritant to Putin and as a potential rallying point for those who are increasingly unhappy with the conduct of the Ukraine war.
So there's Putin's reaction. What about Russian reaction? Is there any word yet on how this is being sold to them? You said Ukraine probably will be blamed for this. What then happens to what was left of the army that he once fronted?
I think the leadership of the Wagner Group, they at least those who are closely tied in to Prigozhin, should hire food tasters as soon as they reasonably can, and stay away from airborne travel. The grunts who form the bulk of it, they're probably safe.
What sort of message does this send? Is that what the idea behind this was for Putin, or did he just want him gone because he was a threat?
Oh, I think he wanted him gone because he was a threat, and also to discourage others who might be tempted to break ranks with him. Mr. Putin has a long history of dealing in very harsh ways with those who fall out with him and with his domestic critics. And Prigozhin alive was a threat. The attempted coup of some weeks back is the biggest break in the heretofore solid front of Russian solidarity that we've seen. And Putin would not have forgotten. He may have been all forgive and forget when he was cobbling together this deal with Prigozhin, abetted by the Belarusians. But I don't think anyone who's not terribly naive would take that very seriously.
How will the West view this? Does this have any impact on the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Not a lot. I mean, it merely confirms what we already know, that Putin is a nasty customer, that he has a nasty way with his critics, and that those who cross him had best be very careful. It may make things a little harder for anyone who's still trying at this very late date to make excuses for him, but I'm not sure there are very many of those left.
Dr. Jack Cunningham with us, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History in Trinity College and the Monk School, University of Toronto. Jack, as always, thanks so much for the time and the insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You too, Scott. Take care.
The federal government's Liberal cabinet retreat wraps up in PEI today. And as you can tell, housing pretty much the top of the priority, top of the agenda, rather, over the course of the last few days. How did it all go? Let's bring in Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director of Abacus Data, here now. Tim, how are you? Hope you're well.
I am good, Scott. Just got back from Newfoundland, actually, so in a good frame of mind.
So, you know what? I saw a picture that you posted on social media of your mother's garden. It was absolutely beautiful.
She, you know what, has managed to figure out our unique maritime climate and always produces a great garden. So it's always a pleasure to go and sit in it and take it all in, particularly when it's the sun shines, because that doesn't happen as often.
It was absolutely beautiful, but I swear I saw Alan Doyle peering through a hedge. I have to look at it closer. You know? I don't know.
You know what? I think he was actually in Toronto that day. But next time, Scott, I'll see if I can get him running around at a leprechaun dungeon.
There you go. All right. PEI, the retreat wraps up. Your thoughts? Man, I'm not sure if we talked about this a couple of months ago, that we would have all said housing was going to be the major topic on the agenda.
And indeed it was, and of course the criticism now coming out of PEI, the setup, as you know, on Sunday, Monday for the cabinet retreat was, this is going to be the focus of the retreat. They're all consumed with it. Prime Minister certainly said those things and mouthed those words, but the criticism, which is probably fair enough, is they're leaving PEI with no plan or no announcements. That I find a bit strange. Look, you should reflect on policy. You should think about what you're going to do. But it is politics, too. It does involve some marketing. They've given their critics an opportunity here by not announcing something coming out of the cabinet retreat. Now, they say they're going to have something to say in the fall, and that's fine. But I think they're still in a pattern of creating more trouble for themselves than they're solving right now.
Many are questioning the total change of tone. I mean, it wasn't that long ago this wasn't an issue for him, and now all of a sudden it is. Maybe is that the reason why there really is no plan? Because there's really been no thought put into it other than the past couple of days.
Yeah, that's part of it. But, I mean, I was, again, when I was in Newfoundland yesterday, I was at an event. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a builder. And, you know, he's saying they're having conversations with different levels of government about what they can do. And you know, one of the things we ended up talking about was, because there's going to have to be something like this, incentives for builders. Well, why couldn't you telegraph something like that? There, you know, we have tax credit and tax breaks in incentive programs for others. There are some things you could at least voice, I think, and then add to them. Maybe you're right. They haven't given it that much thinking. Maybe they don't know where they need to fit, given their role has changed over the years. But I guess the clearest sign we got on direction or pathway from the Prime Minister was, I think it was Monday, he said, you know, this is going to be similar to healthcare. So I don't know. Are we going now to have a First Minister's meeting on housing? That would not surprise me as, you know, something that gets announced before Labor Day and see where we go from there.
The headline on CTV News on the website, Trudeau wraps retreat with message to millennials, no new housing plans, which you just echoed. Is he now starting to refocus on the millennials? Is that why the interest in housing?
Well, he's getting pounded there. I mean, our abacus poll, I was talking to your other Scott. So many Scots on CHB.
I know.
You're my first true Scott. I want you to know that.
but
I told Radley what we've seen on our abacus data, which is real concern for them, is that there's a big gap now between the Liberals and the Conservatives, with Conservatives, I think, having a double-digit lead. You'll remember, Scott, in 2015, the Liberals basically abandoned abandoned the NDP, jumped on board with the Liberals, and propelled them to victory. They're not with the Prime Minister right now. He needs them back if he's going to win, because he's vulnerable among men over the age of 50. He has vulnerability. He's not as dominant as he once was with female voters, but he's still doing better there than Poilievre. Millennials have won him elections. If he can't close that gap, he will not win.
How will the NDP Liberal agreement fly during an election campaign? What happens then?
Well, a breakup is inevitable, right? I mean,
yeah.
Jagmeet Singh, for his own purposes, can't go into an election with an agreement for the future there. I don't think. I mean, he's got to stake a proposition that the value proposition to the public that, look, I'm an important player here. So if you elect more of my MP, more MPs for me, I can be an even bigger player. So I can navigate the Prime Minister's foibles and I can keep the Conservatives away. So, I mean, their agreement does have an end date. I can't imagine that they foreshadow a future agreement, because that will invite all sorts of different political challenges prior to an election campaign. I think a breakup comes. The question is, when does the breakup come, on what issue, and at what cost to whom?
Or if the breakup doesn't come and it ends up being the Prime Minister who calls the election, doesn't that neutralize Jagmeet Singh and the NDP?
Well, I think it could, but I think if an election were called, that would be a sign of the breakup anyway. And the NDP would act accordingly.
What about rumors, rumblings we're hearing of unhappiness within the cabinet itself? People aren't happy with the direction that's going.
Yeah, I think that's true. Look, again, having been out east, where, you know, as I've said to you a couple of times in the last month, the Liberals have dominated and they're not dominating now. I know a lot of Liberals there, including some in caucus, they've not said it to me, they've said it through surrogates, are not happy at the moment. Less so with the Prime Minister as leader, but upset with his decision-making process. So that all sprays itself out in the wash, and, you know, he's still got some stains on him from people in his own caucus. That said, despite his current numbers, it's hard to see, and I think Liberals in their heart of hearts get this right now, today. Maybe it's different in 6 months, but he's still their best asset, and it would remain, you know, it would be foolish a bit to underestimate him. But people are grumbly. It's 8 years. Some people haven't been promoted. Some people are worrying they're not going to get reelected. They don't get reelected, they don't get their pensions, they may not get another job. So there's very real personal dimensions to all of this, thus the carping and the moaning.
Tim Powers with us, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data, the latest coming out of PEI and the big retreat. Tim, as always, thank you so much for the time. Be well.
Hey, talk to you later. Bye.
The latest from Tasha Kieradin, principal at Navigator, author of The Right Path, and columnist for your National Post. Liberal inaction is allowing the Chinese Communist Party to colonize Canada. To talk more about all of this, Tasha is here. Tasha, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Oh, yes, I'm very well. Thank you.
Tasha, is this resonating with Canadians? Because, you know, we've seen the call for a public inquiry go from the front burner to, I don't know, the crock pot now. It just doesn't seem to be an issue for Canadians. Yet, you know, we keep getting hammered with all of the evidence. Is this resonating?
Well, yes and no. It's not resonating the way I think it would if the economy wasn't so bad. People are really concerned about bread and butter issues. They're concerned about housing. They're concerned about inflation still and cost of goods like food. So it's not top of mind. And I think that's partly why you're seeing a lack of action on it, because it's not the biggest issue. And I don't think it's going to be a ballot box issue. And the government kind of knows that.
How is China colonizing Canada?
Well, where to start? We've known about this problem for about almost 40 years now, and you're seeing it in a variety of ways, and I talk about some of them. There's the economic piece, the fact that their state-owned companies have sought to buy out so many industries in Canada, whether it is a smaller thing, not that small, but if you live in the East Coast, but like the lobster fishery. Lithium mines, we actually pushed back against three of them this year. The government said, no, you cannot buy three lithium mines. Then there's the issue of house prices. House prices are through the roof, literally. And there's been evidence. There was a commission down in British Columbia which showed that the laundering of foreign money, specifically Chinese money, of criminal enterprises through the housing market was one of the reasons prices were inflated there. And also the same thing happened in Ontario. The drug crisis, you look at what's happening with opioids and fentanyl. The biggest source of fentanyl in the world for Canada is China. There are so many different things. And the problem is, and it's not to say it's, you know, it's not the people of China. It is the government of China. Yeah. It is the Communist Party of China, that their state capitalism, if you will, is a very different model. We're not on an even playing field, and their objectives are very different than our companies and our governments. So we are at a serious disadvantage, and they're seeking to influence the decision-making in Canada to favor their country. They're not colonizing us in the sense of coming here and taking over, bringing in, when you think of colonization, taking over the entire country at one shot. No, it's a subtle control of the levers of power and mechanisms to get what they want out of Canada and not what we want on all these areas.
Anybody that has followed this in any light at all can obviously see the need for a public inquiry, unless, of course, you're somehow benefiting from this. The fact that this has been just punted down the field time after time after time, does this, many are questioning whether it's the Laurentian elite or other politicians have so much vested in this that it's less about interference from the Chinese Communist Party and more about how it will expose these other politicians that are so woven into it.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot written about what's called elite capture, and this can be flagrant. It can be literally, you know, offering people incentives, whether it's financial, hiring them in certain companies or other places. But it can also be simply very subtle in the sense of just basically getting them to see things from China's perspective. We went through that with John McCallum, our former ambassador to China.
Yeah.
He started singing the praises of Huawei and Meng Wanzhou, and, you know, when she was arrested, and it's kind of bizarre behavior, and you think, well, why? Why would you act against the interests of your own country? It is a way of capturing people through flattery, through treating them well, and sometimes also, unfortunately, through compromising them. And the problem is that for many, many decades, we had hoped and legitimately felt that by trading with China, we'd open up their democratic instincts, and you'd get the things to change, and the government seemed to be more open to capitalism, and this did not happen. It was never going to happen. But in the West, so many people, and many people, well-meaning people, even within the elite, felt that they could contribute to that effort. We know now it did not work. But that also, people now have interest to protect, And so it makes a situation where, you know, it's very hard to go back on 20, 30 years of the things you were doing that benefited you to suddenly say, well, wait a minute, we can't deal with China the same way anymore.
It wasn't that long ago that China was seen as the golden goose. Everybody wanted
Correct.
A piece of it. But what about the public inquiry? Where is this going to go, do you think? I mean, the conservatives are saying if elected, they'll make sure one is called. Where is this going between now and then?
Well, it's going nowhere fast because no one seems to want to run it. This is a problem. This is a big problem, and I don't blame people.
But isn't that up to the government, Tasha? Like, honestly, I'm tired of the government pushing it onto the opposition to do the work for them.
Yeah, it's not. It's. I think the government has said they've approached people. I believe this. They've approached people and they've said no, because it would be very hard to find someone willing to take it on. There have been approaches suggested to the government that they haven't necessarily followed through, i.e. don't just pick one person, pick a number of people, get each of the opposition parties to suggest one person so that you can agree from a panel or whatever. I mean, there's ways of doing this. I think the government doesn't want to do it. I think that they are dragging their feet because it's not in their interest. And they know that the primary target of the inquiry will be them because they've been in power since 2015. It's not to say that other parties won't be affected by what's found, especially around elections and, our voting system. But at the same time, they're the ones who will wear it because they're in power and they don't want to. So they're kicking it down the road and kicking it and kicking it. But at a certain point, you know, they have to do it. And if not, they should get out of the way and get in a government that will.
And it's not just about election interference. It's about what the prime minister knew and when, obviously. Tasha Kierden with us, principal at Navigator, author of The Right Path, and in the latest in the National Post, Liberal Inaction Permitting China to Colonize Canada. Tasha, great piece. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've been talking about the Greenbelt issues and such, and, you know, I've come to the conclusion, and we've got to keep having the discussions about the Greenbelt because the housing situation isn't going to get any better. This is going to need to be talked about for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years like it wasn't for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But I think what we're finally figuring out here is that the same groups or people's extremists, and I mean, I want to protect the Greenbelt. I think most Ontarians do. But the same extremists who are screaming blue murder about the Greenbelt are the same extremists who have not allowed development on the alternatives to the Greenbelt either. And I think that's finally being exposed in this discussion that, okay, there's no sense to use the Greenbelt because there's these 20 to 40 years of land that hasn't been used yet. Well, why has that not been developed for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years? And why are we in a housing shortage then? And I think it's this sort of extremism, which is now sucking and blowing, is finally making us realize that we have to find a solution to the problem instead of playing the politics over a piece of land, which seems to be more important than people living in tents in every town across the country. Hopefully we'll get refocused. On that note, Ontario's Municipal Affairs and Housing Minister says he's looking into potential tax changes to spur the creation of rental units. Let's bring in Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, here now. Ian, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing very well. Thanks, Scott.
Are anti-developers just anti-developers, Ian? Because it seems that the same groups that are protesting, as I mentioned earlier, the Greenbelt, are the same ones that stalled the development on the so-called white belts, where that 20 to 40 years of land has been sitting for the last decade or two.
I've come to a very similar conclusion. I just want to highlight to you and to your listeners a very, very important article that was written in the New York Times, a very liberal newspaper, everybody. And it was about 6 months ago, and it was a very long investigative report in the city of Los Angeles about affordable housing. And the journalists did an excellent job, talked to everybody. They talked to unions, they talked to the homeless people, advocates, and they talked to everybody, including the city planners. And where I'm going, why I want to talk about this story, because it's absolutely applicable to us, was that they went through all the rules and all the regulations, and they found that there were all kinds of rules and regulations that drove up the cost of affordable housing and made the allegedly affordable housing more expensive than the identical square foot condos and apartments that were not designated affordable. Because they what they would do is they would regulate the very highest, the gold standard, instead of putting in, you know, allowing the developer in building them to put in basic taps in the bathroom. They had to put in the absolute state-of-the-art steps and state-of-the-art doors, you know, that were, you know, higher than what you would put in a luxury home. And so what they found was that a lot of this, you know, the road to hell is paved with the very, very best of intentions. And so my sense is that, and I've had this debate in Ottawa, is that there is so much opposition to any expansion. You're quite right. Not just Greenbelt, but any expansion on the edges of the city called the suburbs. And then on top of that, we over-regulate the affordable housing. And so what happens is we put all of these barriers in front of affordable housing. And guess what? People respond, companies respond to incentives. Incentives matter. And so the government is trying to come up with incentives. I'm not trying to say that these potential tax changes are going to solve the problem. I don't believe it. I think it's just one small part of the many things that we have to do. The governments are going to have to do federally, provincially, municipally, if we want to have more housing built.
All right, Ontario's Municipal Affairs Housing Minister looking at potential tax changes to spur creation of rental units. Your thoughts on that? You said one spoke in the wheel, basically.
That's exactly right. I mean, we know this is where I get so frustrated with my progressive friends. And believe me, I'm in the university, so I know lots and lots and lots of progressive people, okay? That's just the nature of the university. And it's so frustrating, you know, because, you know, they say, you know, they'll say, okay, we got to have a carbon tax. Okay, I understand the logic, you know, because incentives matter. They'll tell you, and they do, you know, and let's incentivize people to stop buying gasoline cars and switch to electric. And then they'll turn around and support all kinds of taxes on something that they want to happen, such as affordable housing. Well, the taxes are disincentives. So what the government is doing here is they're mandating essentially some tax reductions for the developers that are going to incentivize the building of more affordable housing. Well, that's one step in the quiver. You know, that's going to help. It's not going to hurt the cause of affordable housing. But I think some people have so demonized the developers. I certainly have in Ottawa. You know, and I listen to my progressive friends talk about developers. I mean, you would think they're the mafia. You would think that they're Putin incarnate. I mean, really, the language that they use to describe developers is really astonishing. And, you know, they're just human beings like everybody else. Yes, they want to make money. I get that. But, you know,
so does everybody else when they want to sell their house.
Yes, of course. And so we've got to think differently. And I won't use that cliche, think outside the box. We've got to re-examine our policies where we put all kinds of barriers and disincentives to the building of houses. One more quick point, Scott, before we run out of time. I was very intrigued at the time by President Obama when he appointed a car czar to address the bankruptcy of General Motors and Chrysler. And he was asked, why are you doing that? He said, I need somebody who will have absolute authority to cut through the myriad of red tape and regulations that block all kinds of change. Maybe we need a czar at the provincial level in Ontario that can cut through and overturn all kinds of these regulations I'm discussing that the New York Times found in Los Angeles and just overturn them. And not a car czar, let's call it an affordable housing czar, that can go in and do what the government is trying to do piecemeal, you know, reduce a tax here, change a tax there, and have an overarching czar for affordable housing that can go into every municipality and say, I've just canceled that regulation or that tax because it is harming the construction of affordable housing. And it worked. The car czar they restructured General Motors and Chrysler in record time, and they produced two profitable companies at the end of the process. Maybe we need something like that.
Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, on Ontario, Canadian housing and tax changes that could help. Dr. Ian Lee, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you very much.
All right. Do we need to reconsider what we once considered the golden goose? Todd Hirsch is with us. He is an author and public speaker, director of the Energy Transition Center, former chief economist of ATB Financial, and has an article in the Globe and Mail from a couple of days ago. Letting go of China's money, the price Canada must pay for its principles. And Todd Hirsch is with us now. Todd, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Nice to be here.
So I remember it wasn't that long ago, Todd, when China was considered the golden goose. Everybody wanted in. Everybody wanted a piece of this. This was the new emerging market and such. Are we now paying a price for that now that the Chinese Communist Party has kind of changed its tune?
You know, that's the great question. It seems about 25 years ago when China was joining the World Trade Organization, they were hosting the Summer Olympics in 2008. They seemed to be playing nicely in the sandbox with everybody. It seemed like this held the promise of a whole new age of trade with the world's second largest economy. And over the last 20 years, Canada and most other Western countries, you know, we really took advantage of that and we went heavy with trade with China, especially importing. But now, and for reasons we can get into, the situation is changing. The geopolitics has shifted. And now there is a question as to, are we finding ourselves too reliant on an unpredictable trade partner?
Have we already woven ourselves too much into this quilt, Todd? I mean, is it 25 years, as you said, of, I wouldn't say dependence on, but certainly it's changed the economy here, changed the world.
It certainly has. And, you know, listeners just need to look around the room that they're in or the car they're driving. Almost everything their eye falls on is going to be imported from China or has some component part imported from China. And this does put us in a precarious situation, particularly as, you know, the tensions between China and the United States, China and Canada, as those relationships become strained. If we find ourselves having to, you know, slap some political sanctions on China, there is a lot at risk. And this is where, you know, my article in the Globe and Mail talks about the price of being principled. Are we prepared at some point, perhaps, to impose those sanctions on China because of a different set of values held by China as compared to us? Or are we going to find ourselves on the sort of the bad end of the stick if China, as we saw last week, you know, imposing some restrictions on Chinese tour groups visiting Canada, leaving Canada off the list of approved destinations? It really was kind of a slap in the face to Canada, a needless one, but it is going to have an economic impact.
Another slap in the face, many would say. Many would also say, why aren't we doing the right thing? You know, many have asked the question, too, about even something as simple, well, not simple, but a public inquiry. Like, why just not get this done? Is it that there are too many politicians that have woven themselves into this narrative? That if you expose that, you'll expose them?
Well, there is that. I mean, getting into the politics, this is where, you know, Netflix, I'm sure, could make a whole miniseries about the complexities of it, and it would be compelling watching. But economically, there are, you know, it's not quite as straightforward as saying we're going to cut off trade with China because we are so tightly integrated with their economy already, again, especially on the import side. So we're going to find out just how principled we are. Are we going to put our principles as a country ahead of the economy? That's tough to do. It's maybe easy to say in principle, but when push really comes to shove, are we going to allow major sections of our economy, our manufacturing, our tourism, our energy and commodities industries, are we going to let them maybe face some of the wrath because of the principles we hold? So this is why I think the next few years are going to be really interesting and maybe a little perilous for Canada, for our politicians, and maybe for our economy.
And this just isn't about cheap stuff. It's about taking over the interest of business and such. It's embedding them into society.
Yeah, that's right. It's more than just, as you say, it's more than just cheap toys and you know, inexpensive clothing. It really does cut to the core of Canada as a global economic player. And, you know, there's been talk about, you know, in the United States, their bill to increase manufacturing of microprocessors, of computer chips in America. This whole idea of friendshoring, in other words, shifting away as much as we can from trading with potential adversaries and making sure our trade connections, our global connections, are with those countries we feel 100% certain that are going to remain allies with us. But even if we do that, you know, it's still not quite as straightforward, because the global economy is so it's such a complex knitting of where component parts and inputs come from and where they go. So even to say, well, we're only going to trade with perhaps Denmark, for use them as an example. Well, whatever we import from Denmark, there might be a component part in that good that comes from right. China. So it's going to be really difficult to unravel this, maybe impossible to unravel it. But again, our principles as a Western liberal democracy are going to be tested.
That being said, the tone has changed, Todd. Are they feeling the pinch? I mean, we certainly know that China's economy is hurting right now. That's their post-COVID, challenges and such. But as the world pulls back from the world's biggest factory, are they going to take note of this?
They might. Canada, we're not an insignificant player, but we're pretty small for China as a trade partner. A lot more depends on what the United States and maybe what the European Union will do to hit back. But Xi Jinping, the leader of China, he's in an interesting situation. His economy is faltering. They're not coming out of COVID as strongly as they thought they were going to be. Their housing market and their real estate market is looking very, very shaky. He's got a lot at stake personally. And if, in fact, China's economy really starts to falter, he's going to need a win to sort of bolster support within China and within the Communist Party in China. And that bolstering support might be, you know, hitting back hard on countries like Canada. This could play out a lot of different ways, the geopolitics. But China will feel some of the pinch, especially if the U.S. and the European Union, the larger economies, also start hitting back. But that might put China, sort of like Russia has been with Ukraine, it might put them in a tighter corner, and then you never know what they're going to do.
Only got a couple of seconds left here, Todd. Just, I can't let you go with your energy connections to the thoughts of the environment minister heading over to China to talk climate change. Is this an exercise in futility? I mean, I guess it's always great if we're talking, but...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what will come of it. I guess politically it is necessary, because the politics of these things, the optics are that you must remain talking, that you must continue those diplomatic conversations. What will come of it is really difficult to say. I can't get into the mind of Chinese leaders at the moment, what they might be thinking around the environment. I know that they could say with legitimacy, hey, look, we are the world's largest producer of green technology, solar panels, wind turbines, and we're doing our part by being the manufacturer of that. And I think there is some case to be made. But I still think that countries like Canada are also going to want to see China move further and move more quickly on reducing carbon emissions. So it is going to be a fascinating political conversation for them.
Todd Hirsch, author, speaker, director of the Energy Transition Center, former chief economist at ATB Financial, and the latest in the Globe and Mail is letting go of China's money, the price Canada must pay for its principles. Todd, thank you for the time. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. You too. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.